Good morning, everyone. It is Monday morning, July 2nd, 2012, wherever that lies in infinity. And it is hot, hot, hot here in Winnipeg. It's looking like it's going to be a wet and hot, sticky day. I hope things are fine in your part of the world, wherever you are. I've had 8 questions come in this month, and those should lead to some interesting areas of response. As always, I want to thank Marcus Fellows for establishing this website and for posting these talks each month and making this situation possible in the most direct way. Thanks to those who have tuned in and sent in some of these questions. I want to give everyone a bit of a heads up on the fact that this year it seems I will end up in California for a period of time in within the first 2 weeks of September. I've been invited down there to hold a few gatherings. So there, it looks like right now it looks like there will be about 9 gatherings, and they will take place in various parts of California, both the northern areas and the southern areas. So there are a few in the Bay Area. There are some north, I think as far north as Ukiah, and there will be some held down near LA, Santa Monica, Redlands. So, as soon as we have some kind of actual itinerary established, we'll post that information on the website. As I say, it will take place in the first 2 weeks of September. I don't know how long this response is going to be. Some of these questions, I have the feeling they're going to open up into quite a broad area of response. So let's get down to it and just see where it goes. A first person has written in saying, "Hi, Daryl. I just listened to your latest talk. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your work. Your books are really the clearest books I've read on this subject. These things have been chewed in your books and talks 1,000 times, but what the hell? Let's chew them one more time." So one more time. Why do you choose to call Fred or Tao an event or a happening and not awareness or consciousness? Many non-dual teachers are giving the impression that what we are is consciousness, that is aware of life, and this consciousness needs no brain or body to be conscious. So there's a promise of afterlife, some kind of floating consciousness in space, forever in bliss. What do you think of this? And a second question, do you think that the whole point of this non-dualism is identity, to get to know what you are? Many non-dual teachers are giving this impression. One said that identity is inherent in consciousness. If all there is life or Tao or whateverness, then why does it need identity? Isn't making an identity just the same thing as labeling, creating non-existent forms out of a formless dance, and that is the whole problem in the first place? And then we try to seek liberation from it? Well, that's all. I hope you have a really great summer and a holiday, a good holiday. Best wishes. All right, so first question, Why do I choose to call Fred or Tao an event or happening and not awareness or consciousness? And for those who don't know, he's using the word Fred here because I've made the comment from time to time that I will call the great unexplainable happening of existence Fred. Just because it's so, like, it's absurd to me to be calling it anything at all. But in certain situations, it seems as though we need a label. And I kind of like calling it Fred to some degree because there's a certain irreverence to that that I enjoy. But basically what he's asking is, why is it that I call the great unexplainable, or why is it that I would use terms like unexplainable event or happening rather than the words awareness and consciousness when I'm referring to the basic sense of presence that we have? In my sense of existence, in the you know, basically there's just the sense of something happening in this moment. Now, this happening is not something that can be identified. If I drop all the labels that I've been trained to bark, there is still somehow the sense that something is happening in this moment. So, you know, for lack of better terms, there is the feeling of an event taking place. Now, that event is not a thought. And what I would mean by that is that if you take your fingers and you pinch your arm, you can call that a pinch, but the actual happening isn't a word, isn't the word pinch. You can drop that label, the word pinch. And the happening makes itself obvious. This happening that we call a pinch, it makes itself obvious without calling it anything at all. You don't have to call it a pinch. You don't have to call it awareness. You don't have to call it a happening. But whatever this is, it makes itself obvious. It doesn't require some movement of the intellect to make itself obvious. There it is. It just is. Now, I've noticed in my own apparent experience in attempting to express what is generally known as a non-dual perspective, I've noticed that if I use the word awareness or consciousness, people in general will assume that that is personal awareness, their personal awareness, the idea that they have about some invisible awareness inside their so-called head, and this invisible awareness is looking out, and that, you know, at death, at the so-called moment of death and the body dies, this invisible awareness floats off to exist somewhere else. Now, in my so-called experience of existence, there isn't any invisible awareness inside this so-called head looking out at the world or perceiving a world. What there is fundamentally is this event. And so the and I use the word event or happening as a pointer to this sense that something is happening in this moment. Words are really very limited in this. They can only point to what is making itself obvious in this moment. There is the feeling that something is happening in this moment. That, you could say, it's a physical event, and it's not a word, it's not a label, it's just this happening. And to me, that's a more direct pointing than using words like awareness or consciousness. Because those words give you the impression that that is some fundamental reality, that there is something actually there that we can actually know is something called awareness. But we can't know that. When this event or this happening first makes itself evident for every so-called human being, there is no set of labels that comes with it. In everyone's apparent experience, we learn to bark certain labels concerning this, I don't know what you would call it, like this fundamental happening of existence. So, as I've said a million times, if we're relating to a baby that is 1 hour old, and I ask the baby, like, what's this all about? The baby isn't going to give me any response at all. The baby isn't going to say, well, we're fundamentally pure awareness, or we're fundamentally pure consciousness, and that's all that actually exists. For this so-called baby, there is just this strange happening, a buzzing, swirling event. And again, these labels aren't meant to tell you what it actually is. It's just pointing to the basic fact or the basic feeling that there is something happening. There aren't any labels for it for a baby that's 1 hour old. No one apparently arrives with a set of labels. Everyone's apparent experience indicates that it takes years for us to be trained to bark these labels, and then somehow along the way there's the feeling that those labels are a true labeling, that they really are telling us what is actually happening here. When initially, it's just a meaningless sound that's attached to some portion of this mysterious happening. And it doesn't matter how many sounds point to the various portions of this mysterious happening, it remains fundamentally a totally unexplainable happening. So again, in my apparent experience, to use words like awareness or consciousness, most often people grab on to those words, feeling that somehow that's a fundamental explanation of existence. And in my reading of many of the individuals who have used those words to point to the fundamental happening of existence, and to the scriptural passages that will sometimes point to the fundamental happening of existence, when they used the word awareness or consciousness, they weren't talking about somebody's individual consciousness. They were talking about the basic sense that something is happening. So what is our most basic sense of being aware? It's just the feeling that something's happening in this moment. That is fundamental awareness, what you would call fundamental awareness. It's not actually something called fundamental awareness or pure awareness or pure consciousness. It's just a label attempting to point to this basic sense that something is happening in this moment. It's not ultimately saying that that's something you can call consciousness or you can call awareness. And, you know, I look at certain teachers that have used those terms, individuals like Nisargadatta Maharaj or Ramana Maharshi. And in the case of Nisargadatta Maharaj, there's one last book of his teachings that were put together or collected shortly before his death. And he made it a very specific point to say this is not consciousness. It's not something called consciousness. It's an unexplainable functioning, a playfulness, a liveliness, and you cannot identify it in any kind of conceptual way. So there's just this happening, and it's simply happening. If we look at someone like Ramana Maharshi, he would say, oh, you can call it awareness, you can call it consciousness, or you can just call it existence, beingness. Like, he would throw out any number of labels for this, and he would say, I don't really care what label you use. You can just call it whatever you want to call it. In the case of someone like the Buddha, there's one entire sutra where he is pointing out that, let's see if I remember correctly, I think it's the Sutra of Sati, the fisherman's son. So if I remember correctly, Sati was going around teaching that consciousness went from one body to another. And the Buddha pulled him aside and said, why are you teaching that? Like, I don't teach that. I don't teach that any particular thing goes from one moment to another. There is nothing that goes from one moment to another. And he really gives this Satya chewing out over this whole thing. So, within the teaching of the so-called Buddha, he's very specifically pointing out that he's not saying there's something called consciousness that goes from one moment to the next or from one body to the next. He's saying that whatever this is, whatever the unformed, the asankata is, and by that, you know, in my own sense of it, I would take that to be the unformed event or happening of this moment, whatever that is, it's not an identifiable thing that goes from one moment to another. It is something that has no particular form from one moment to another. It only appears to have form. And that someone who ultimately realizes this, they will realize that any of these descriptions, any of these labels, they don't apply to what's actually going on here. So as this person points out, using the word awareness or consciousness, it is leaving people with the impression that after this body dies, that we will be some kind of floating consciousness in space, forever in bliss. But I haven't run across it. Any so-called legitimate teaching that is actually saying anything along that line. It's attempting to point out that what's happening right now, whatever this is, whatever actually is not identifiable in any way. It doesn't have a form. And, I mean, we can get poetic about it. We can say it's the unformed dance of the universe. We can say it's the unformed ocean of existence or the river of life. We can call it the Great Spirit. It's simply attempting to point out that all of our storylines about some little thing that's been born into a world and that will eventually die out of this world, all of those storylines are false. What is just this great, miraculous, unformed dance of the moment. And that is the only thing that ever is. And it's just doing its thing. It's just spontaneously dancing in whatever way it moves, whatever way it shifts. And that's the only actuality of this moment. So any concern regarding death may fall away with the so-called realization that there is only the dance of the universe. Again, universe literally means undivided turning. So we do not exist as anything other than a portion of that great mysterious dance. And that great mysterious dance is all that is. there is no question of it dying out of existence. It's impossible to consider that existence itself is not going to exist. And actually, we can even step out of terms like existence and non-existence, because right now, as we're listening to this talk, or as you're apparently listening to this talk, there is the feeling that there is existence. But tonight, when you're in a sound sleep, there won't be any feeling that there is any existence. So again, this fundamental happening doesn't have a fundamental form. And there's no way of saying what that is in any way whatsoever. We don't have any tool for saying what this isness is. And even terms like isness become ridiculous, because nothing actually ever is. Whatever seems to be is always on its way to something else. So people will say that there is just beingness, but nothing is ever being. There is no particular form that ever comes to be. There's just this totally unexplainable dance, always apparently moving on to something else, but it never actually becomes something else. So even terms like isness or beingness, or a term like becoming, doesn't make any sense, because it never becomes anything in particular. There's just an ongoing absence of any particular form. Often teachers will describe this in terms of negation. It's not this and it's not that. And they're just trying to point out that whatever it seems to be, it's not that, because there is no ongoing form. It's just this dynamic function or playfulness or liveliness. Again, these aren't meant to describe it in any way, but words like playfulness, liveliness, functioning, these seem to point to this isness without actually trying to label it as something in particular. And that's simply what I'm compelled to do. I'm drawn or compelled to use the words that point to this event or this happening. Words like event or happening seem to point to the isness of this moment without attempting to give it any understanding or give it any name, give it any thingness. All right, the second question. Do you think that the whole point of this non-dualism is identity, to get to know what you are? Many non-dual teachers are giving this impression. One said that identity is inherent in consciousness. If all there is life or Tao or whateverness, then why does it need identity? Isn't making an identity just the same thing as labeling, creating non-existent forms out of a formless dance? And that's the whole problem in the first place. And then we try to seek liberation from it. So, yes, I agree with these comments that to try to give an identity to this unexplainable, unformed functioning or dynamic or dance, and to believe that that identity is some kind of reality, that creates seems to create a whole bunch of problems. In a way, it's not fundamentally a problem, because if that occurs, that is the expression of this great unformed dance. And ultimately, we can't say what that is. But within this realm of non-duality and a consideration of what it is we're exploring in what's known as non-duality, yes, to try to give identity, some basic identity to existence, that gives rise to a lot of difficulties. But I'm not so sure that that's what's being pointed to with this quote. Apparently, one teacher has said to somewhere along the line that identity is inherent in consciousness. Now, one person can listen to a line like that, identity is inherent in consciousness, and they can be thinking, oh, what we are is something called consciousness, an impersonal consciousness that contains all of existence, and that's my identity. That's what I actually am. And another person can listen to that line, and they have the sense that this word consciousness is not being used to label existence. The word consciousness could actually be used to simply point to this happening of this moment, the sense that something is happening in this moment, and that that can actually have no label whatsoever. And that that event or that dynamic playfulness that can't be labeled, can't be understood, can't be truly described in any way whatsoever, that's what is. That's the only thing that is. That is the identity of all things, the true identity of all things. And that doesn't leave us with something to describe. It doesn't leave us with something called consciousness. It simply leaves this dynamic playfulness, the dynamic functioning or action of this moment, the event, the happening, the dance, the flowing, the fact that all apparent things are actually motion, ongoing motion, that it is unformed and ultimately unexplainable. And in that, you're not left with the sense of, oh, I am something that I can label with the word consciousness. Instead, it strips away any possibility of saying what actually is, and yet it leaves this apparent event of the moment. It leaves this basic happening of existence that we call existence, and that this happening is not a particular thing to be described. It's just some magical, dynamic playfulness or liveliness or functioning, a movement, a swirl. And that event is all that there is. And so the identity then is not something described. The feeling of identity is this event. But you don't say, that's what I am. You simply say, there is just this. And at some point you even drop that phrase. Okay, question number two. At this rate, this response may last until October. Hi, Daryl. What do you think about coaching? With right efforts and guidance, people seem to improve their lives, although under the illusion they are the authors of their lives. Also, I want your thoughts about why you think most religions are against desire and sex has become a problem. Masturbation is to be avoided, homosexuality considered unnatural, and women have to dress modestly. Is desire really the cause of dukkha, of suffering? Celibacy or sexual relationship between man and woman, which is it? May you please share your thoughts on these things. Okay, let's go through these point by point. What do you think about coaching? With right efforts and guidance, people seem to improve their lives, although under the illusion they are the authors of their lives. So, coaching. If we look around the apparent world, we find certain situations in which people are being advised to live in a certain way, and if they live in that certain way, they will reap certain benefits. So, you know, certain teachings will say that if you eat well, exercise, think good thoughts, that you will lead basically a healthy life. And that's great. However, before you even get to approach those kinds of teachings, you have to be given a basic interest in living life in that way. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with living life in that way. Just as some people may want to refine their ability to throw a basketball through a basketball hoop, other people are drawn to refining the way that they live life, to refining the way that they move their bodies, to refining the way that they eat in a way that, even though it doesn't guarantee that you'll live longer or that you'll be healthier, the odds, you know, the apparent expression of existence indicates that the odds are good, that you are, by living this way, by eating well, by exercising, you are supporting whatever life you're given, you're apparently given. But we should also note that not everyone wants to do this. So before you can even consider that this is a reasonable way to live life, you have to be given the interest in living life in that way. Other people are given an interest that may override certain healthy behavior. So let's say you have an incredible interest in journalism, and in order to pursue that interest in journalism, you will have to be flying all over the world. You never know how your day is going to shape up. You will have to take advantage of whatever opportunities come along in relation to your career as a journalist. You're often staying up all night. You are often working to deadlines. You do not have access to a refrigerator that is filled with only healthy food. So you find yourself eating fast foods. You find yourself wolfing that food down in order to get through to certain deadlines, wolfing that food down in order to simply keep yourself going in relation to this larger pursuit, this larger interest, which is to have a career in journalism. Now, it doesn't matter how much you say to that person, look, you know, you should have a more regulated life. You should be getting up at a certain moment each day, and you should be doing this amount of exercise, and you should be eating only organic, free-ranging, whatever, carrots or chickens. It doesn't really matter. It should be organic, and it should be pure, and you should take time to cook it properly or eat it raw. It doesn't matter how much you advise this person who's working for some big news corporation, no matter how much you advise them to live in that way, their interest in life is something else. So coaching is great, because basically coaching exists in all realms of existence, whether it be a career in journalism or a career in physical fitness and healthy eating. Coaching apparently exists, but what coaching are you going to be interested in? Before you can approach life in any way whatsoever, there has to be some essential interest in life. And those interests vary to a great degree. And as I'm always pointing out, Schopenhauer said it really well. You can do whatever you want to do. It's just that you can never create your wants. Your wants are given. Now, a non-dual perspective could say, you know, well, Schopenhauer was limited in that expression, because it's not really you doing what you want to do. that ultimately it is this unformed, unexplainable happening of existence. It's just like a river flowing, and that river has an essential current, an essential flow, and nature provides its apparent direction. And it's the same with us. Or we could say it's the unformed ocean of existence, and each apparent thing is a wave on that ocean, and it's the ocean itself that is moving each wave, because each wave only exists as a portion of the ocean. That is the movement of the ocean. So again, the ocean has its inherent expression. We could say that's the expression of nature, or the universe, or the great spirit, or whatever you want to call it, because there is only this great swirling dance of existence. In all of these situations, it's fundamentally just the movement of this unexplainable event. However, in our apparent lives, in the world of apparent form, yes, it seems like there are certain people that are moved to certain areas of life, and they have certain interests, and so they participate in certain forms of coaching. And some people are coached to be great journalists. Other people are coached to live life in some kind of physically healthy way, some mentally healthy way. And that's great, because that apparent coaching is ultimately simply the movement of this greater mysterious event of existence. So participate in life in whatever way you're compelled to participate in it. From a non-dual perspective, it's just simply asking you to consider that whatever you're doing, whatever you're apparently doing, is ultimately not your doing. You don't create your needs, you don't create your interests, you don't create your concerns, you don't create your abilities, you don't create your lack of abilities, your basic talents or your basic lack of talent. All of that is simply the movement of this larger mysterious event. Second question here. I want your thoughts about why you think most religions are against desire and sex becomes a problem. Masturbation is to be avoided, homosexuality considered unnatural, and women have to dress modestly. I have absolutely no idea why nature expresses itself in that way. Fundamentally, for me, there's just the happening of this moment. There is no way to explain what this is. There's in any way whatsoever. There's no understanding of this event, this happening at all. And yet it's all happening. So, you know, in this particular moment, there's actually no understanding of what any of this is. These apparent words apparently come out of my mouth in an apparent response to apparent questions, but fundamentally there's just this event. There's no explanation for it whatsoever. There's just this event expressing itself. So whatever this is, it's just happening the way it happens. Now, I know a lot of people can get into a whole storyline about how, it's because people want control, and they think if they gain absolute control over their desires, that somehow they're going to find themselves moving to some place of endless bliss. And so things like sexual desire are a problem. Desires of all kinds are a problem, and we need to learn to drop them. And yes, there are those apparent groups that teach that, and if you're drawn to that, that's great. But as far as the world of non-duality goes, what's considered to be a legitimate non-dual expression is not going to be saying things like this. Ultimately, it's going to be saying whatever happens is the natural expression of existence. Actually, it's the natural expression of something that no one can really say anything about at all. There's just this happening doing what it does. So to say that it's correct or to say that it's not correct, this makes no sense whatsoever. There's just this mysterious event doing what it does. And it's going to apparently express some people in a way where they will have the feeling that desire is inherently harmful, sexual desire is harmful. They're going to say that masturbation should be avoided, that they're going to apparently make judgments on things like homosexuality and the way women dress. And that is just the way nature expresses itself. It's just one of the many ways that this great mysterious event of existence expresses itself. There is, from a non-dual perspective, there isn't any way of explaining that. It just is what it is. It's just doing what it does. Okay, the next question in this note is desire really the cause of dukkha? So since this person has used the word dukkha, obviously this is coming from the teachings of Buddhism, and many people have the impression that the Buddha said desire is the cause of dukkha, or like the word dukkha is a Pali word. The Buddha's teaching was recorded in the Sanskrit dialect known as Pali, and the word dukkha is generally translated as suffering, but probably a more exact feeling of that word would be a sense of unsatisfactoriness, so that it doesn't feel as though life is ultimately satisfying. So the question is desire really the cause of this suffering, this sense of unsatisfactoriness? So since he's used the word dukkha, it seems to me this is obviously coming from the teaching of Buddhism. And so we have to be very specific as to what the Buddha's teaching was regarding desire being the cause of suffering. He did not say in a blanket term, desire, all desire is the cause of suffering. What he said was, according to the recorded teaching, I don't really know what he said, but according to the recorded teaching, what he said was, the desire that arises when things have the appearance of being ultimately pleasant and satisfying, or when things have the appearance of being pleasant and ultimately satisfying, that desire is what creates the sense of unsatisfactoriness. So, when things, apparent forms, have the appearance of being pleasant and ultimately satisfying in some way. So if we start looking around and we see a world of forms and we identify certain ones as being pleasant, certain emotions, certain situations, certain objects, whatever, we start identifying certain ones as being pleasant and we start believing that those apparent things are going to be ultimately satisfying, then it's the desire for those things, or that strange belief that we're going to be ultimately satisfied by these things, that's what creates the unsatisfactoriness. See, what we call desire in general, like the desire to eat, the desire to sleep, the desire to have a glass of water when we're dehydrated, that doesn't produce some kind of essential suffering. The desire for a meal doesn't present any essential feeling of unsatisfactoriness. It's just a fact. We need to eat in order to live. And we know that having a meal is not going to satisfy us for the rest of our lives. Having one meal is not going to satisfy the need for food for the rest of our life. However, in some cases, we start believing that if we just eat more food, we can keep ourselves feeling happy. The gallon of ice cream when we're sad, the box of cookies when we're feeling lonely, we start to having the feeling that we can use these things to ultimately get rid of that feeling of sorrow or loneliness or whatever. That's the desire. The desire that's based on that strange idea that we're going to ultimately keep away the bad things in life. That's the desire that ultimately creates the disappointment, the unsatisfactoriness. Because we're not going to keep those unpleasant things away by constantly eating. Nor are we going to keep them away by constantly drinking alcohol or popping pills or having sex or... So it's this strange idea that we're going to somehow gain an absolute control over existence by pursuing certain apparent things, and that those things are ultimately going to keep us satisfied. That ultimately leads to a great disappointment, and that is the dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness that's being pointed to in Buddhism. And then this last question, what's it going to be between man and woman, celibacy or sexual relationship? And I don't care. Whatever you're drawn to is fine. If you're thinking that celibacy is somehow going to make it easier for you to be enlightened, or somehow that it's a necessary element of spiritual awakening, it's not true, because there have been many so-called awakened beings that were married. There have even been situations where it's been recorded that certain apparent people actually came to enlightenment while having sex. So while participating in the sexual act. And in other cases, people have led a life of celibacy, and they have also come to some kind of spiritual awakening. From a non-dual perspective, it's saying ultimately you don't have to really be concerned about this. You don't have to decide which one's the right one in order to have spiritual awakening. It can happen in all kinds of situations. There isn't any specific situation that will simply give rise to a so-called spiritual enlightenment. And that ultimately, whether you're drawn to celibacy or sexual relationship, you don't really have any say in that. You will be expressed in whatever way you're expressed. A third person has written in saying, Daryl, I'm sure you're familiar with the three stages of spiritual progress in Zen. In the beginning, rivers are rivers and mountains are mountains. With insight, rivers are no longer rivers and mountains are no longer mountains. The final stage is when rivers are rivers again and mountains are mountains. It seems most non-duality pointers are geared to see the second stage of insight. What would be the equivalent non-duality pointer for the third stage? Thanks for all your talks. So what this person is referencing is a Zen Buddhist teaching. If I recall correctly, some student asked the teacher what Zen was all about, or, you know, what is the whole Zen journey of realization. And this teacher said, in the beginning, rivers are rivers and mountains are mountains. Then rivers are not rivers and mountains are not mountains. And then rivers are rivers and mountains are mountains. So what does this fundamentally relate to? In my sense of things, it would be that most of the time we run around thinking that we can identify what existence is. We have the word river, and that points to this event that we call a river. And we believe that that is really something called a river. So once again, we believe that our storylines are somehow fundamentally telling us the truth about existence. When in fact, at some moment, we may realize that actually we don't know what any of this is. So So when this great event of existence first apparently presents itself, and we could say, you know, basically when we're babies coming out of the womb, or it probably occurs before we apparently come out of the womb, that when we're fetuses in the womb, there is some fundamental sense of something happening, a fundamental sense of existing, the basic feeling that something is happening. That has no label. So we can talk about, you know, for a fetus in a womb, there is this fundamental sense of happening, something happening. But for the fetus, there isn't even the notion of being a fetus in a womb. All of that has to be, a so-called baby has to be trained to spout that storyline. But for the so-called fetus, there isn't even a notion of being a fetus in a womb. All of that comes later. We're told to describe existence in that way, apparently. So, as this is pointing out, initially rivers are rivers and mountains are mountains, but with insight, there can be this realization that, no, that's not true. We don't know what any of this is. We don't know what these so-called rivers are, what these mountains are. They're a great, unformed, mysterious event, a happening, a dynamic, a great spirit, the flow of nature, the river of life, the unformed ocean of existence, the formless, the unformed, the Asankhata, the Tao, Yahweh, whatever you want to call it. But then within this Zen tradition, they're saying that then mountains, or rivers are again rivers, and mountains are again mountains. So initially with this insight, there's a very radical realization that there's no way of saying what any of this is, but you're not going to sit around never having a thought again, or never participating in existence again, and never participating in a conversation again. Or it's likely that that isn't going to happen. Because for most of us, we're expressed in a way where we will be a portion of so-called society, we will be engaged in conversations, thoughts will continue to come. There are occasionally individuals, so-called individuals, that are expressed in a certain way, and they go off to some cave somewhere and attempt to live outside of society as much as they possibly can. But even for them, they will still have a head full of thoughts coming and going. So again, there can be this radical realization that thought can't tell us what any of this is. But after that realization, the thoughts will be presenting themselves, and there will be an underlying sense that they themselves are simply a great mysterious event that can't be explained in any way whatsoever, and that everything we are is an expression of that great mysterious event, and we will simply be expressed in whatever way we're expressed. So some people are expressed as business people or scientists, apparently scientists, or philosophers, artists, mothers and fathers, social workers, whatever, monks and nuns, whatever. And all of these expressions are the legitimate expression of this great mysterious event, and there isn't any particular individual, apparent individual anywhere, that's actually deciding what their expression is going to be. So ultimately, it doesn't matter if you're a nun meditating in a cave, or you're someone who is living only to be chairman of the board of IBM or whatever, or Apple Corporation. It doesn't really matter, because ultimately, all of that is the expression of this great mysterious dance of existence. So there's another Zen story where an old man is walking up the mountain, a mountain, with a big heavy bag on his shoulder, and a monk recognizes that this old man is a great master, and as he passes him, he stops and he says, "Tell me," he says, "what is enlightenment?" And the old man lets this heavy burden fall from his shoulder, and he stands up straight. And the monk says, and what do we do after enlightenment? And the old man lifts the heavy bag on his shoulder and continues to walk up the mountain with a great deal of difficulty. So, yeah, to have the realization that this is a great mysterious event, totally unexplainable, in a way it could be called miraculous, because everything is simply given, everything you are is an expression of this great mysterious dance of existence. And so all burdens are removed in that realization. There's nobody doing it, there's nobody to blame for it, there's nobody carrying it. You're simply a portion of this great mysterious dance, this great mysterious expression. That's all there is. Nothing else is. But what do you do after that realization? Well, you appear to be simply an ordinary human being participating in existence the way everybody else is participating. And you will have apparent burdens. Life will seem difficult at times. There may be great physical hardship. There may be emotional situations that are difficult to deal with. All of that is the natural expression of this great mysterious event. And fundamentally, it's not anybody's burden to carry, although some days it sure seems like a burden. But the fact is, whatever happens after this realization, this apparent realization, all of that is the expression of this great mysterious dance, the great spirit, the unformed ocean of existence. And yet, on a day-to-day basis, it seems to be an individual shouldering the burdens of life. However, even within those storylines, we can realize that we don't create our bodies, we don't create our brains. Even within those storylines, this holds true, that we don't have the feeling we created our brain, we don't have the feeling that we created our bodies, we don't have the feeling that we're making them function the way they function, we don't have the feeling that we created our basic needs, the need to go to the toilet, or the need to eat food, or the need to have a certain amount of social contact. We don't have the feeling that we've created our basic talents or our lack of talents. I mean, one person can do amazing things in one area of life and can't do anything at all in some other area of life. And someone else seems incredibly ordinary, yet on the day-to-day grind, apparent day-to-day grind of existence, they seem to be able to handle whatever comes along. You don't get to decide what your abilities and lack of abilities are going to be. Even if you refine a certain talent, you don't create the urge to refine that talent. All of that is simply the expression of this larger mysterious event. So we start out, there's this very, what we consider to be a very ordinary life. We think we understand what everything is. Then there may be a moment of insight. And we realize that there's no way of saying what any of this is, and there's nobody doing it. It's simply a great mysterious dance. But it will go on presenting itself in a way that appears to be an ordinary human being going through the various ups and downs of existence. And so our very ordinary life is the great spirit. And there is no expectation that it will be only golden glowing moments. There is simply whatever life expresses. Now, this person is saying that it seems that most non-duality pointers are geared up to seeing the second stage of insight, which is that there is only this great mysterious dance, that there really aren't any rivers and there aren't any mountains. And that may be true. I don't know if it is actually true within the world of apparent form, but Even if it is true, there's no problem with that because the rest is going to take care of itself. If you really do see that this is a totally mysterious event simply presenting itself spontaneously and that you're not doing it, that you are simply an expression of this greater mysterious event, you will come to realize that it's not going to play out in some kind of constant golden glowing moment. You are left with what apparently seems to be your ordinary life. In most cases, apparently, it's no more special than anybody else's life. And all of that is the natural expression of this great mysterious dance. So to have this realization, you don't have to be concerned about where it's going, because once you have the realization is it's going to go wherever it goes. We're simply going to be expressed in whatever way we're expressed. It has always been simply this great mysterious dance expressing itself. Okay, I am going to have to divide this response into two sections. However, I want to include one other question in this first portion, and you may want to pause this at this point because this next question is a big one, and I'm not sure how long the response is going to go on. So, anyway, here we go. A fourth person has written in saying, "Hi, Daryl. Hope all is well with you, and thanks for your monthly question and answer sessions. Sorry this question is so long. I would really appreciate your take on this. Thanks. The question is, for a while now, I have had some trouble reconciling some of my behavior with the non-dual perspective. The fruits of this perspective have definitely been self-evident in ways that I cannot describe. However, in a very honest and worldly sense, I have also been struggling with an addiction to cigarettes. I obviously feel very conflicted about this. It seems to me that this addictive behavior is certainly not in alignment with the truth that non-duality points to. However, when the impulse arises to smoke, my mind creates a convincing dialogue that says there is no doer. This is a spontaneous occurrence. Nisargadatta Maharaj was a chain smoker. Don't resist this. It's an inexplicable happening, etc. I then act on the impulse, and afterwards the mind rationalizes the behavior with more of this pseudo-logic, falsely claiming that it is life doing what life does. This is, of course, coupled with all sorts of guilt, inadequacy, and other afflictive emotions. Common sense tells me that something is amiss." Now, this person goes on to say that one well-known teacher of non-duality has given him an answer in relation to this situation, and he basically has sent a couple of pages of this response. So I'm not going to read this response verbatim, but just in general, whoever this is that gave this answer has said to this person that addiction of any sort, whether it's inappropriate sexual behavior, alcohol, drugs, smoking, or any milder form of behavior, almost always has its origin in the belief, and more importantly, the feeling that we are a separate, limited, located self. And that this gives rise to, like, feeling that we're somebody separate gives rise to a rejection of existence, so that we ultimately end up saying, I don't like what's going on, and I want something other than what's going on. Now, it's this resistance to what actually is that is our basic problem, according to this teacher. And that we really have to address that root problem, or else we're going to be left with some kind of addiction. And this person points out that this person is saying that even our focus on unnecessary thinking is an addiction. It's perhaps our most basic attempt to get away from what actually is in life. This teacher also goes on to say that this feeling of separation carries with it a fundamental insecurity. The feeling that there is this self that's going to die at some point, that's always being faced with change, decay, and all of that, and that basically this ultimately leads to an obsessive focus on the world of thought in order to somehow give some substance to this fleeting self. It's an urge to try to keep this self that seems as though it's going to disappear, to keep it alive. So ultimately, what is deemed too boring, plain, and uneventful to be worthy of attention, and thinking provides an alternative dream world into which we can escape from the boredom and discomfort of the moment. So to wrap this up very quickly, this teacher is saying that ultimately we have to begin exploring this sense of separation. Initially, we will explore it conceptually. Somebody will point out the fallacy of this self that is separate from existence, but we can't just leave it as some kind of intellectual understanding, that we really have to get down to feeling the basic event of the moment and the basic discomfort of this feeling of being separate, and that we really simply have to, to paraphrase, we simply have to embrace the discomfort of the moment and not run off to obsessive thinking or drinking or sexuality or cigarette smoking or whatever, to simply feel the basic discomfort of existence as a physical event or an emotional event, and that without the urge to try to escape that, and ultimately this primal cause of addiction will fall away. There will simply be this openness to the event of life just as it is, and no longer this false sense that I am ultimately somebody separate from it and I will escape it somehow through my various indulgences. So let's go through some of this. This whole area of addiction seems to be of great importance to a large number of people. And there are a number of different aspects to this situation and this question that are probably worth considering. First of all, in this person's first direct question, he's saying that he has this addiction to cigarettes. There is this impulse to smoke, and he finds himself actually using a non-dual teaching in order to somehow allow himself to smoke. So, and he's feeling that there's something not quite right in this situation, that there's something off in this situation. So he says the impulse arises to smoke, and his mind creates a convincing dialogue that says there isn't any doer, that this whole urge to smoke is an impulsive, spontaneous occurrence, and that Nisargadatta Maharaj was also a chain smoker. So basically, what's the problem? Don't resist this, it's an inexplicable happening, etc. And then there is the acting on the impulse, and afterwards the mind rationalizes the behavior with more of this pseudo-logic, falsely claiming that it is life doing what it does. This is, of course, coupled with all sorts of guilt, inadequacy, and other afflictive emotions, and common sense tells me that something is amiss. So, first of all, nothing is amiss in this. And it's very interesting because what's being described here is a very accurate description of how life expresses itself. So, it is true that there is no one deciding to be addicted to something, that it is the basic movement of life that has given rise to this impulse to smoke and the right now the subsequent follow through to smoke. Now, all of that is this spontaneous expression of existence. Now, a lot of people have the impression that if they see that clearly, then life will express them as a very different human being. Or they're feeling that if they just see life in this way, then it doesn't really matter what happens, they're going to feel okay about everything that happens. And that's not what a non-dual teaching is saying. A non-dual teaching is saying that life is expressing itself, that this isn't a situation where we're making life move in a certain way, and that life will express itself in whatever way it expresses itself. So, this person at this moment is somehow thinking that if he simply convinces himself that life is, or I don't think it is a case where he's simply convincing himself that life is a spontaneous occurrence. He actually sees that to some degree. However, there hasn't been an actual acknowledgement of what that ultimately means. So there's a hope that to have this understanding is going to clear away the difficulties of life, but that's not what this teaching is saying. It's saying that to have this realization will leave you only with the fact of existence, that existence will simply continue to play out in whatever way it plays out, and that ultimately we don't have any say in how that plays out. There may be the hope that if we understand this, that from that moment on, whatever happens will be fine. It will feel fine, whether we smoke, whether we don't smoke. All of that will be seen to simply be the unformed ocean of existence, and everything will feel wonderful. Whatever happens will feel wonderful, but that's not what happens. So that even if you do radically realize that your addiction is not your personal doing, that doesn't necessarily leave you feeling okay about that. Life can still apparently express you in a way to attempt to move you out of that addiction. Even if you see that the addiction itself is the dance of nature, there can be all kinds of guilt feelings around that. There can be all kinds of feelings that this is not a healthy way to be living. And all of that is ultimately this divine dance as well. So for this person, try as they might to use this teaching to get some specific result, and in this case, maybe it's the result of feeling that, oh, everything's okay, it doesn't matter whether I smoke or not. You know, if I just see that it's the unformed dance of existence, I'm going to feel totally fine about this. That's not what's necessarily going to happen. Somebody may see it as the unformed dance of existence, someone such as Nisargadatta Maharaj, and they may be left with the feeling that, well, there's nothing I can do, it is the unformed dance of existence, who really cares? Another apparent person may have that radical realization that it is the unformed dance of existence, and the unformed dance of existence may express that apparent person with the feeling of guilt around smoking. It may express that person with the feeling that this is not a healthy way to be living, and it may push that person away from the addiction itself. There's no way of knowing exactly how existence is ultimately going to express you. So we have these situations where Nisargadatta Maharaj, apparently a fully realized human being, lived out his life addicted to cigarette smoking. Alan Watts, who, as far as I can see from his writings and the understanding that he expressed, or the perspective that he expressed, from the age of 14, had the impression that he was an expression of the larger event of existence. And yet, around the age of 60, he revealed to a friend that he didn't like himself when he was sober. Or we have somebody like Chogyam Trungpa, who essentially drank himself to death. He died of cirrhosis of the liver. Again, you know, when he fled Tibet, he was considered to be the most realized of all the young Tibetan teachers, and yet lived out a life in which there seemed to be a great deal of apparent loneliness, a great deal of womanizing, and a great deal of alcohol consumption. and at a certain point, not too long before his death, he began to give a teaching on how to use drunkenness as a spiritual practice. So there we have a very clear expression of so-called individuals that are highly realized. They know themselves to be the dance of existence itself, and yet they're expressed in ways that we probably don't want to be expressed. Ways that we wouldn't assume that a realized being would be expressed. So that's a simple observation on the expression of the unformed dance of existence. We also have, you know, I don't know Wayne Lickerman personally, but we have this story about Wayne Lickerman, who was essentially addicted to alcohol and cocaine through most of his life and made every effort to drop that addiction, and at some point realized that no matter how many times he tried to drop it, he wasn't able to drop it, and basically had gotten to a point where he felt he was going to be addicted to these things for the rest of his life. And then, as far as the story goes, he goes on a camping trip, he wakes up one morning, and he has the feeling that he's never going to indulge in these addictions ever again, and doesn't. And it's a year later that he begins to explore the world of spirituality. He can't figure out what happened. Like, the addiction just left without any effort whatsoever. He had made all this effort through all these many years, and nothing happened. And when he had totally given up, sometime later, it just melted away. And so he was left confused as to what that was all about. And a year later, he starts investigating the world of spirituality, and not too long after that, he runs across Ramesh Balsekar explaining that there is only the unformed dance of existence. We're not in charge of it. We're not making it happen. So there's another observable expression of the unformed dance of existence. It's not falling into any particular pattern. It's just the dance of existence doing what it does. Now, in relation to this response that this other non-dual teacher has given this person, this non-dual teacher has said essentially that almost always addiction has its origin in the belief, and more importantly, the feeling of being a separate, limited, located self. So, saying that the origin of addiction is this belief that we're something separate from the movement of existence. Almost always. So obviously, it's not always the case. If this person is saying it's almost always that it has its origin in this, they're saying it's not always that it has its origin in this. So that's another thing we should note about this response. But this person, this teacher, goes on to explain that really all we have to do is begin to explore this feeling of being a separate individual from the movement of existence and come to see that it's false. But more than come to simply see it intellectually, we have to come to the feeling of being separate, the feeling of wanting to resist life, and pause in relation to that. Not just for a moment, don't follow that urge to resist life and just see what expresses itself. And ultimately, we will, in some way, open to the full expression of life, to all the fears, all of the insecurities, and we will open to this basic physical happening of existence. And in doing so, the urge to move away from what actually is will fall away, because within that openness, there is a sense of peace and well-being that ultimately we will want more than the addiction, more than the escape. So at some point, the apparent peace and well-being of this openness to the happening of the moment will override any urge to escape what seems to be an irritation or a difficulty or a discomfort of the moment. And the sense of being a separate self will fall away, and the need to have an addiction, the need to try to escape the discomfort of the moment, that will fall away. Now, that's all of this, from my perspective, is a way to explore the situation, and you can explore it in this way if you're drawn to explore it in this way. And it may be that as we move into this exploration of the feeling of the moment, the basic physical sensations of the moment, there will be this sense of peace and well-being, and that will eventually become so strong that it will pull us away from or it will dispel the urge to escape the discomforts of the moment. It may work out apparently that way if life expresses you in that way. Even if you're drawn to explore existence in this way, it's not necessarily the case that you have the capacity to experience this physical, or to apparently experience this physical happening of the moment, nor is it necessarily the case that you will have the capacity to face the discomfort of the moment. So to say this is what we need to do in order to move away from addiction, it needs a certain qualifier here. If you're drawn to explore life in this way, and actually, it's more than drawn, if you're compelled to explore life in this way, and you have the capacity for everything to unfold in this way, that's great. But you should keep in mind that this is like telling somebody that if you grow a pair of wings and you flap those wings, you will fly. The essential element here is whether or not nature is going to give you the ability to grow a set of wings. And in this situation, to say that really, basically, you just have to explore this feeling of being separate. Initially, you explore it conceptually, but you can't leave it at a conceptual level. Essentially, you have to come to experience the discomfort of the moment, the discomfort of what life is presenting in that moment, and open up to the fact that there is just this great mysterious event, and in that there is a certain sense of peace and well-being, and that will eventually dispel the urge to escape the discomfort of the moment. To say all of that, it has to be based on the fact that if life compels you to explore in this way, and if life ultimately expresses you as having the capacity for any of this to happen, then yeah, it may happen in this way. But that's not guaranteed. And so it is that within various approaches to addiction, to exploring addiction, if we take an approach like AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says the first and foremost thing that you have to realize is that you may kick your addiction, but it will only be with the help of a greater power, however you imagine that greater power to be. Now, some people will call it God, and they'll think there's some great power living somewhere else, influencing you and running your life, and that's fine. My way of expressing it is that there is simply a great, mysterious, unformed flow of existence, and if life is, and we're all expressions of that great unformed event, and if that great unformed event expresses you in a way that you will explore addiction through this exploring the idea of being a separate self, and that ultimately will lead to an open-heartedness around the presentation of any moment so that you're open to all of the discomforts and ultimately an urge to escape those discomforts, if they're not life-threatening, the urge to escape those discomforts will melt away and you'll be left with the full vibrant expression of existence. That's great if life expresses you in that way. However, if you're not drawn to that particular format for existence, fortunately, there are other formats. Not everybody approaches addiction, the exploration of addiction, through a non-dual perspective. So we have other organizations like Alcoholics Anonymous. They explore it with some other format. There are many people who work at kicking their addictions outside of any particular institution or organization, and there are any number of approaches that they might use. Something that comes up in relation to this particular answer that was given by this, I don't know who it is that's given this answer, so I'm not making any comment on the person who has offered this teaching on non-duality in relation to addiction. I don't know exactly what the context was that where this response was given. I don't know if this is the entire response, the entire teaching regarding addiction. So I am not making any comment about any particular teacher. I'm simply commenting on what this person has told me was the response of a particular teacher. But one of the things that comes up in relation to this response is to notice that ultimately this person is saying that pretty much all of our behavior is addiction. Now, it's great to explore life through certain formats, but we have to be really careful with certain formats because ultimately those formats start making claims that really can be detrimental in certain ways. So to consider that all of the expressions of humankind are fundamentally addicted, from a non-dual perspective, there may be a case to be made for that, but ultimately that case is not truly the non-dual perspective, because the non-dual perspective is ultimately saying, I don't know what's going on here, or even more succinctly, it's saying there is no way of saying what is going on here. So we have to be careful with any intricate explanation of existence that any so-called non-dual teacher is giving, because those explanations of existence are not actually what's going on here either. Those explanations for existence are not the truth. And if we look to what has been considered the legitimate non-dual expressions of existence, things like the Ashtavakra Gita, even though they use all kinds of different terminology and they may use the word consciousness and the word awareness, they ultimately end up saying that you cannot define what's going on here in any way whatsoever. That it's not a bunch of things influencing other things. It's not a person separate from some world of things. It's simply a great mysterious event, an unformed ocean doing what it does. That nobody's in charge of the ocean. So we have to be careful with some of the explanations, because anytime we get into explanations, some of them, it seems as though they seem to be serving us to some degree, but they also at some point carry some dangerous side effects, apparently dangerous side effects. So on one hand, it might be great to explore the world of addiction through the idea that it's based on, ultimately, on this sense of separation, being separate from the rest of existence. But that's not fundamentally a non-dual teaching. The non-dual perspective is fundamentally saying there's no way of explaining what's going on here ever, at all, at any time, at any apparent time. There is no possible explanation for what's going on here. It just happens the way it happens. Now, within this world of exploration, you may be drawn to explore this feeling of being separate from existence. You may be drawn to open to the discomfort of any particular moment. And you know, it's like a conflict of aches. You have the ache of life, which may seemingly provoke an addiction to something like alcohol or cigarettes in order to escape the uneasiness of the moment, but at some point the addiction itself creates an uneasiness. We know it's unhealthy. We know that it's bad for us. And it may be that existence expresses us in a way that the ache of the addiction starts becoming stronger than the ache of life. And at some point we may find ourselves pushed to simply experience the ache of the moment without an escape, because the aching quality of the escape has become a much bigger ache than the ache of life, than the pain of life. But all of that will be the expression of whatever life is. There's no way of saying ultimately what this is, or ultimately what exactly is going on here. This whole storyline of addiction is just one particular conceptual format for this. And we should note that if we start considering that almost everything in our behavior is addiction, that will carry the feeling that there's something inherently wrong with existence everywhere. That inherently we've all gone the wrong direction, when in fact a non-dual perspective is saying there isn't any wrong expression of existence. There's just the dance of existence. If the dance of existence expresses you, or apparently expresses, the feeling of discomfort with life in general, and it expresses an urge to escape that discomfort through excessive thinking or excessive sexuality or excessive drinking or smoking cigarettes or whatever, all of that is the divine expression. And if the urge is still there, if the urge arises, in which case the apparent addiction itself becomes a bother, that is the divine expression. And if the urge to move away from the addiction, if the addiction itself becomes a great ache or pain or suffering, and it ends up being a greater suffering than the pain of the moment without an escape, then perhaps you will apparently be compelled to drop the addiction, because the pain of life is of life without an escape is less than the pain of life with the escape. But all of that is simply this divine expression. So again, I am not making any comment on any particular teacher that made these particular statements. I'm simply commenting on what is contained in these statements. And I don't know the greater context that these statements were lifted from. So I'm not making, you know, I don't know the person who made these statements, so I am not making any comment on that person's sense of existence or their sense of non-duality or whatever. I'm simply making a comment on these particular expressions. And to round this out, let's get back to this particular person who wrote in saying, I have this cigarette addiction, and when I have the urge to smoke, the mind rationalizes this whole thing by saying, there is no doer, this is simply a spontaneous occurrence, don't resist this, it's an inexplainable happening, and yet, he's left with all sorts of guilt, a feeling of inadequacy, and other afflictive emotions. Yes, this is the legitimate expression of existence. You are not going to use a non-dual teaching or a non-dual understanding to get life to move in a direction that you want it to move. So you might be wanting to have a non-dual expression so that you feel good about every bit of your behavior. But the non-dual sensibility is saying that you will be expressed in whatever way you're expressed. In this particular instance, it's not saying that if you have an addiction and you have a non and you gain a non-dual sensibility, you will feel wonderful about the addiction. It's not saying that. It's saying if you have an addiction, even if you see that that addiction is the dance of the unformed ocean of existence, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to feel good about it. And it may even be the case that you will be compelled at some point to drop the addiction, the apparent addiction. I don't know how it's going to express itself. Ultimately, a non-dual sensibility does not leave you with any reason for any of your behavior. You are simply the compelled expression of the ocean of existence. As it says in the Ashtavakra Gita, that someone who has this sensibility is simply moved like a leaf blowing in the wind. It's a physical expression. It's a physical event. The leaf doesn't understand why it's moving the way it moves. It's just blown in the wind. Or as Christ pointed out, the wind blows wherever it blows. You can't know where it's coming from and you can't know where it's going to. So it may be that like Nisargadatta Maharaj, this particular person may live out an apparent life being addicted to cigarettes, or it may be that unlike Nisargadatta Maharaj, this particular person may be compelled to ultimately drop the addiction at some point. And in either case, there is no ultimate understanding of why that happens from a non-dual perspective. Again, all of this is simply offered for your consideration. I'm not asking anybody to look at life this way. I don't think anybody has to look at life this way. This is one of the many mysterious expressions of existence. It's not the one true approach to existence. It doesn't matter what anybody offers from their apparent perspective. That's not the ultimate truth. It's just one of the many expressions of existence. So we'll end this portion of this response here. And if you want to go on to the second part at some point, you can click on that when you're ready.